Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center.
The challenge before us is not to change human nature. That's not it. It's rather to reinforce undervalued traits that are in all of us. So the problem before us is simply how to recognize these qualities in us and build upon them.
Talk is cheap. Actions speak louder than words. That may be true, but we live, we act in an environment of ideas.
Environment, philosophy, and American values, this week on Soundings. My guests are Francis Moore LePay and J. Baird Callicott. Francis Moore LePay's most recent book is Rediscovering American Values, published last year by Ballantine Books. J. Baird Callicott has written and edited numerous books about philosophy and the environment. He's currently at work on an edition of The Ecological Conscience, a collection of essays by Aldo Leopold. Baird Callicott and Francis Moore LePay, welcome to the National Humanities Center and to Soundings. I guess it's fair to say that the environment is getting a lot of attention these days. But is that a big deal in and of itself? Baird, let me begin with you. What kind of attention is the environment getting?
Well, I consider the attention that it's receiving today the second wave of the environmental crisis. The first one hit in the late 1960s, and we had a spate of palliative legislation in the 70s. It was forgotten during the Reagan years in the 80s, and now it's back again with a vengeance.
Mm-hmm. I remember a phrase in the beginning of one of your books. Stuart Udall, was it? The quiet crisis?
The quiet crisis.
No longer quiet. Well, somewhat, huh?
Well, I think that Stuart Udall gave the cachet to the environmental problems as a crisis, and indeed it's no longer quiet. I think it's in the news practically every day.
Mm-hmm. What does the environment have to do with philosophy? Let me ask you to continue, Baird.
Well, Roderick Nash, who is an environmental historian, was once asked, what is the worst sort of pollution? As he's on a lecture circuit, students and the public would ask that. And his favorite answer is mind pollution is the worst kind. So I think that philosophy has everything to do with the environment, to the extent that we philosophers are not closeted ivory tower humanists working on special philosophical problems, but dealing as philosophers once did in the grand old days of our tradition of Plato and Descartes and so on, with the fundamental concepts of nature, human nature, and their relationship.
Francis Moore LePay, let me draw you into the conversation. Here, your spouse is a philosopher. Does he talk in philosophical isms? Utilitarianism and this ism and that ism. How does a philosopher talk about the environment?
Well, I think our work is very similar in the sense that we both are trying to address the underlying ideas that people hold about who they are to each other and in relation to the earth. So in that way, we have a common language that we talk in, which is wonderful. But my current work in Rediscovering America's Values is precisely this, to really look at the big ideas that we hold and how they so mold our sense of our relationship to the earth. In other words, if we see the earth as a quarry to mine, mm-hmm. Then we cannot have a healthy relationship. And so these fundamentally are philosophic ideas.
Well, let's talk for a moment historically, and then let's talk about, you know, the mutual overlaps in your work, Baird Callicott, Francis Moore LePay. How have philosophers talked about the earth? How are they talking about it now, and how should they talk about it, Baird?
Well, historically, I think that a major thrust of our work as environmental philosophers has been to explore the historical attitudes that we have inherited from the Judeo-Christian tradition, the Greco-Roman legacy, modern philosophy. I like to talk about despotism from the Judeo-Christian tradition as one of the ideas of our relationship with nature that has, I think, led us astray. The mechanical philosophy of the Enlightenment, in which nature is pictured as a vast machine. Mm-hmm. What do you do with a machine? You tinker with it, you transform it. So I think that the historical analysis is a major effort that we in environmental philosophy have undertaken mm-hmm. to get a better feel for the relationship that we've had with nature in the past.
What about today, Francis Morlepe?
Well, I'm been focusing more on the limits of the giant isms as constructs. I mean, whether we're talking about capitalism or, as I would call it, statism, the Eastern model, and how once we believe that we can sort of give forth our own valuations, how we can sort of give over our own value judgments to a rigid construct, to the notion that there are laws of the marketplace, or there are laws of state planning that determine our relationship to the earth, how we use the earth, then we're lost. Then there can be no constructive relationship. So one of the things that I'm attempting to do in my current work is to help us see that the laws of property, the laws of the marketplace, are simply devices that human beings have created.
Mm-hmm. Are you simply masquerading as old-time Marxists here? Help me to understand what's new and distinctive about what you're saying.
Well, I think most people, at least the received Marx, is very much panned these days by environmentalists who see Marxism as just another approach of seeing the earth simply as, again, a quarry to mine mm-hmm. for human interests. So I don't think that label at all fits. In fact, what I'm trying to do is precisely move us away from the isms. Mm-hmm. And again, to put our own capacities for evolving values through dialogue. And that's when my book is written, as a dialogue.
Well, again, not to single out one system of belief. That's not my intention. But Baird Callicott, I could accuse you of being a sort of soft-minded Christian here about the environment. You know, we're going to leave it alone, do unto others, and all of that. Now, obviously, I'm challenging you. Help me to understand, again, what's new and distinctive about what you're saying.
Well, I think that there is a, in environmental philosophy and ethics, I think that there is a tradition of ethics involved. And I do think that we human beings have a capacity for an affective relationship with others from the Judeo-Christian point of view. And you might say that we environmentalists are attempting to extend this sense of affection, of community, to the natural environment. So it's not a label that I would really like to ignore. However, the intellectual content of it, the foundation for this, is very different, I think, from the soft-headed and perhaps soft-hearted Christian ideal.
Francis?
But your current work, Baird, very much focuses on the non-Christian, all the other traditions, the great religious traditions that have a very much within them an incipient environmental ethic, if you will. So I think you should defend yourself against any sort of narrow label about the Christian grounding, because it's very much universal in just about every philosophic religious tradition.
Absolutely. I wanted to dissociate myself really from the conceptual content, the cognitive content of Christianity about a creator or a God on earth or anything like that, and simply say that there is, I think, a terrific and very basic and universal humanism, ethics in Christianity, and I think that I find that as well in many other cognitive traditions as well, in Buddhism and Taoism and so on.
Do you find yourself, Baird Callicott, in the minority, as it were, as a philosopher? How, for example, let me get personal, you go to a philosophical academic convention, and they say, uh-oh, here he comes, watch out, you know, another one of these cause-type philosophers. Talk to me about that.
You've hit a very, very sensitive nerve as a philosopher you notice that my academic credentials say professor of philosophy at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point.
Mm-hmm.
You'll find that most of us environmental philosophers and animal rights ethicists are at the branch campuses, not at the centers of power and prestige in the academic world.
And this speaks poorly, what, about our sense of philosophy, the way philosophy gets done these days?
In my opinion, it does. Uh-huh. I'll be perfectly frank. I think that through the 20th century, philosophy has dug itself into a kind of narrow furrow from which it's very, very gradually climbing out. And I think that we're labeled as, applied philosophers. Mm-hmm. It's not really that at all.
Popularizers.
That too, I think that we're actually dealing with doing philosophy as philosophy once was done, rather than as a sort of highly technical and narrow specialty in the academic right. world, the queen of the sciences, and that's very threatening, I think, to the people at the in the academic establishments.
Well, what should we do? I mean, here you sit and talk about philosophy and ethics and land management, and we hardly have touched Francis Moore-Lepay on some of your subjects, world hunger and food. And nutrition, things like that. So I say to you, talk is cheap. What do we do? I mean, what does a writer, a philosopher, do to move people toward the points of view that you are arguing here? Francis Moore-Lepay?
Well, the unity that we find in our work is very much that what I'm trying to articulate at the Institute for Food and Development Policy, where I'm based, is very much the social analog of the environmental ethic. In other words, once we begin to understand that our nature is very much socially defined, that we as human beings, as human personalities, as characters, that we are defined by our social reality, by the matrix of relationships in which we live, just as a species is defined by mm-hmm. its relationships, then we begin to see that if that is true, then we each have some power because we each are affecting others around us. No one is utterly powerless, therefore, to make change. So this begins to open eyes and ears and possibilities, because I think we've lived in this world, this Enlightenment inherited worldview, where there is power is this one-way force. There is the power holder and there is the victim. And I think a lot of us end up feeling like victims.
Mm-hmm.
In this new philosophy that's tied to an environmental ethicist vision that Baird represents, we see that we each can have effect, that we each are part of our environment and therefore affecting it every day and all the choices we make, such as the choice of what we eat,
mm-hmm.
The choice of what we allow our children to watch on television, another pet theme of mine, what problems we're working on in our workplace, in our community, and how we're going about that. In other words, it opens all sorts of possibilities once we break out of this sort of zero-sum idea of power.
All right. Well, tell me about you've written a book called Diet for a Small Planet. That came, what, in the early 70s?
71.
How is the diet these days?
Well, globally, it's getting much worse. I mean, we see these sad contradictions that in the United States, I think there are signs that our awareness of what the earth can sustain and what is healthiest for us is improving. Worldwide, however, we are pushing an unhealthy diet. We are pushing a grain-fed, meat-centered diet throughout the world. I was just sitting on a train in rural China two summers ago, and across the aisle from me, I was noticed the autobiography of Lee Iacocca, and saw the whole emergence of this idea that everything Western is great, mm-hmm. everything Western is what we want to aspire to. I was in Japan recently, and
Lee Iacocca is not the commonplace reading in China. You're not suggesting.
No, but
that.
I'm saying this is the ethic of greed. Is what is being pushed as the Western way. Mm-hmm. The Western diet is a symbol of that. The status diet now in Malaysia or in Peru or in Japan is a grain-fed meat diet, which is unsustainable for our planet and
right,
healthy.
Let me challenge you. We're the greatest society on the face of the earth, people will say. What's wrong with the way we're living? I mean, let's look at ourselves triumphantly. Give me the basis for the critique.
I think it's pretty widely accepted that the wondrous parts of our culture, the the risk-taking qualities that we have in this culture, the experimentation. The downside of that is that that we have not been as reflective and as conscious of the impact of our choices, and this is what we're coming up against today. So that the agricultural system, a heavily petrochemical dependent agricultural system that we have become dependent on here, even the National Academy of Sciences knows now that it is saying now that it is not effective, nor is it safe. And yet we are pushing again. We are advocating this for the rest of the world. We have been throughout our aid programs promoting this model of agriculture. So that's just one example we have created a way of living which is neither healthy nor sustainable nor replicable for mm-hmm. the world as a whole.
What does a philosopher have to say about this? Would philosophers attack what Francis Moore LePay has just outlined here, Baird Callicutt, defend it on what grounds?
Well, I think many philosophers would attack it, those that you mentioned in the centers of academic power and prestige. mm-hmm. But certainly I wouldn't, as a philosopher,
Fair
attack
enough.
It. I agree. And I think most of my colleagues in what we like to think of as a revolutionary philosophy movement would also quite agree.
But I think that it's not just that we're saying, oh, you Americans, you have bad values. I think that many Americans are themselves very, very disillusioned and very disheartened and finding empty the track that we're the bill of goods that were sold. I was struck by a recent book last year called Modern Madness, or interviews with 250 very successful professionals in Washington, D.C. And the author concludes that some vast majority of them find their lives frighteningly empty and devoid of enduring meaning. And,
A Woody Allen movie, right?
And so I think that it's not just those of, I mean, I don't feel like an outsider anymore like I used to. I mean, this is a big change for me. I feel like really there are more and more people who are questioning the way, the many of the values that the consumerism that really is a post-World War II phenomenon. And so I don't feel that really like I'm on the outside. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm trying better and better to voice what many people are saying.
Increasingly speaking from inside the circle. Baird Callicutt, Francis Moore LePay just uses a word, values, which is great fun for the philosophers. Where do they come from? Humanity? From nature? Where do you ground them when you talk about the earth and environment and the way we eat, all of that?
Well, I think that you've touched on the center of a debate, actually, in environmental philosophy and ethics, and in philosophy classically in the past, and that is, where do values come from? Where are they located? Frankly, I think that values are essentially subjective, that we value things, but I don't think that this is merely a matter of relativity. I think that our values are informed by our ideas, and I think that we are, that further they're constantly changing, and what I'm interested in doing in my work is to create an intellectual construct in which we can begin to shift values away from artifacts to natural things, to from material possessions and so on, to experiences of nature. So I'm frankly admitting that values are in us. They mm-hmm. come from us, but they're neither relative nor arbitrary.
Francis Moore LePay.
One of the ways that Baird and my work has a common root is that I think we both strongly identify value in deriving, evolving out of human feelings. And one of the things that I think we've both quoted and used is sort of the unheard Darwin. Most of us grow up associating Darwin with a very sort of dog-eat-dog notion of human sentiment and...
Nature red in tooth and claw.
Right. Well, the other Darwin is a Darwin who, the Charles Darwin, who wrote very clearly that indeed evolution favors mutual aid and cooperative feelings, and that actually in our tribal origins that we judged good and bad solely as it affected the well-being of the tribe. And so that out of our very need to preserve ourselves is the need to preserve a healthy community. And so our values are very much related to our feelings. And so that whether we're talking, so that whether we're talking about the environment as we are here or other aspects of ethics, that we I think I can speak for both of us, that we're saying that we can draw on human feelings that have evolved over eons, mm-hmm. and that those feelings can allow us to respond with real emotion to the beauty of the environment, to the sensibility that we are connected to its well-being.
Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation, Francis Moore LePay and Baird Callicott. Let me give you several quick shots here. We've got 5 or 6 minutes left. Baird, you've criticized the animal rights movement, that is to say, the people who speak for animal liberation. Is there internecine warfare here? I thought this was you were all a monolithic, let's go save those animals kind of thing, huh? How about it?
I have criticized them, and there is some internecine conflict in the sort of non-anthropocentric ethics movement, if you could want to call it that. Right now, however, I'm trying to put it back together. I have the paper that I'm presenting here is called Animal Liberation and Environmental Ethics Back Together Again, and I'm looking for a means of healing some wounds that I'm afraid I was instrumental in inflicting.
Mm-hmm. So you won't put that behind you. You won't put that behind you.
A little bit. The differences are very real in terms of practical differences. You often find animal rights advocates and environmentalists on different sides of the same issue.
On what grounds? Very quickly.
For example, endangered species of plants on islands where there are feral goats or rabbits, which are threatening those plants. So the environmentalists are for saving the plant species. The animal rights advocates are for leaving the animals alone to uh-huh. hell with the plants. And uh-huh. so this is just one sort of classic case. But focus of, more theoretically speaking, the focus of environmental ethics is on whole species, biotic communities, ecosystems. The focus of animal welfare ethics, animal rights, animal liberation is on individuals.
All right, well, given that as a backdrop, Francis Moore LePay, let me challenge you with this. What do you say to the farmer in Nebraska or the cattle rancher in Nebraska, the tenant farmer in Brazil or the logger in Oregon whose livelihood is going to go right down the tubes if we implement some of these, well, I take them, rather drastic measures that you're advocating with respect to the environment, the food chain, diet, all of that?
Well, I would say that in many of these instances, farmers here and in Brazil, that their livelihood is going down the tubes now because there is this increasingly here and in such countries as Brazil, a growing consolidation of ownership of these resources. And so my call primarily is to get farmers involved in protecting their own interest as they rethink the use of the land. It's not telling them to sacrifice their well-being. It is being sacrificed now because of a whole belief system mm-hmm. that puts the right to unlimited accumulation of property above other values. And so my call, first of all, has to do with challenging that set of values that allows the consolidation of landholding, which wipes out the livelihood of these people, and involving farmers themselves in thinking through what is a healthy pattern of, mm-hmm. I mean, are you really a healthy farmer if your farm animals are unhealthy?
You see yourself there's on their side.
I do, yeah. And I think it's very unfortunate if it's seen any other way.
Uh-huh. Baird?
I also see there is a coincidence, a convergence between the interests of the environment and human interests. In fact, this is the focus of my current work. Farmers in Brazil A New York Times study has recently shown, actually can gain a better livelihood from standing rainforest by mm-hmm. harvesting its various products, thatch, fruit, nuts, etc., and clearing the forest, and having ephemeral cattle ranches, which generally fall into the hands of large landholders. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so what we're looking for is the win-win situation where the environment and the human community are mutually supportive, and that hopefully can even be mutually improved. I don't think that the environment simply needs to be left alone. In the tradition of Aldo Leopold, I'm for active management for the sake of the integrity, beauty, and stability of the biotic community as well as the human community.
Fair enough. Let's conclude our conversation, Francis Moore LePay and J. Baird Callicott. Francis, you've written a book. You're a vegetarian. You've written books on planetary diets. Give me a good recipe.
He's the cook.
He's the cook. How about it, Baird?
Well, how about a recipe? Actually, we're both from the South, and one of our very favorites is black-eyed peas, buttermilk cornbread, mm-hmm. brown rice, and turnip greens.
Oh, but no special advice on how to cook these things, right?
Baird's advice is that you put hot peppers and use plenty of hot peppers and olive oil, and you will have a great meal no matter what ingredients you cook, as long as they're vegetarian.
The program is Soundings. This is Wine Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion with Francis Moore LePay and J. Baird Callicott. Francis Moore LePay's most recent book is Rediscovering American Values, published last year by Ballantine Books. J. Baird Callicott is at work on an edition of The Ecological Conscience, a collection of essays by Aldo Leopold. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 491. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, American Poets and Poetry. My guests will be James Applewhite of Duke University and Richard Wilbur, former Poet Laureate of the United States. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. Happy birthday this week to the creator of the world's first pair of blue jeans. Levi Strauss was born in late February 1829. The Grand Canyon National Park was established by an act of Congress in late February 1919. Another large national monument, the comedian Jackie Gleason, was born in late February 3 years earlier in 1916. Other late February birthdays include the poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, born in 1807, the singer and songwriter Fats Domino in 1928, the novelist Victor Hugo in late February 1802, the operatic tenor Enrico Caruso in 1873, the essayist and philosopher Michel de Montaigne in 1533, the bandleader Glenn Miller in 1904, and the frontiersman William Frederick Buffalo Bill Cody, born in late February 1846. Finally, happy anniversary this week to the Peace Corps, established by President John F. Kennedy in late February 1961. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Environment, philosophy, and American social values this week on Soundings. Listen for Francis Moore LePay and J. Baird Callicott. Francis Moore LePay's most recent book is Rediscovering American Values. J. Baird Callicott is at work on The Ecological Conscience, an edition of essays on environmental philosophy. Earthly Ethics, some answers and insights this week on Soundings.